Hello and welcome to recording number 30 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is October 8th, 2021. On Wednesday, in recording number 29, Gord and his companions had discovered surreptitiously the ambush that Obmi had set by Ecladra. And Gord had decided to go on ahead in cat form, alone, to scout out what was happening, and he informed his companions not to come after him, that if he didn't return, that he was as good as dead, and they needed to leave him. So Gord first goes to Obmi's camp, and there he spots Leda. And in the reaction that is kind of unsurprising for Gord, he immediately condemns Leda because he feels that she's betrayed him. And without question or anything, and last we had seen of Leda was when Gord had been struck by a lightning bolt while hanging from the ceiling of the temple in the City Out of Mind, and his scorched body had fallen unconscious to the ground, while Obmi and Bolt and his nomad retainers swarmed around, leaving Leda no other options, and being chased by two nomads herself. And then Ecladra appears with her drow, and a general melee takes place. And so, Gord, understanding that Leda needs to kill Ecladra, and that they have both said that that the final key is more important than their own relationship and love for each other, he immediately condemns Leda on seeing her with Obmi opposing Ecladra. And, you know, it is the earmark of Gord that he has this immaturity, but it is really shown in the story, really highlighted right there, just how immature they've Gygax has made Gord. And at this point in the story, he's had a number of bad relationships and one good one, semi-good one, with the Tigerware and the Catlord's domain. And it is surprising, but that's all story, you know, and the Gord story is the Gord story, and it really doesn't affect the lore too much, and it doesn't affect Gygax's ability to wonderfully describe things and illustrate game mechanics, but it is a tad disappointing as far as the storyline goes. But its relevance, I think, is very minimal. And then Gord goes over to Ecladra's camp. Now there's a pause in the fighting between Obmi and Ecladra. They've had the first rush. Some of the drow are dead. Many of the Wulhini, the marshmen from the Hul Marshes, who Obmi enlisted to aid him in his attack upon Ecladra and her drow. And so there's a lull, and Obmi is trying to bribe the marshmen to attack again, and he does. He gives them a big pile of golden gems, and so there were about 100 of these marshmen, and about 20 have been killed at least, and it is kind of surprising that they would be willing to go in for a second beating at the hands of Ecladra and the drow, who are high level, very powerful, and a lot of magic being thrown back and forth. And all the while, Obmi and Leda stand in the background watching these poor marshmen take the casualties while they save their strength for their own attack upon the survivors, whether it's marshmen or drow. All right, I'm going to restart, and Gord has crept into Ecladra's camp. And he sees her on her own after giving her orders to the drow, her drow retainers and her human retainers. And I'm going to start a little back where we have been on recording 29. It is page 351 and the third paragraph down from the top. The High Priestess was traveling light, or at least it seemed that way at first. But then her small backpack began to yield a surprising amount of gear as she busied herself pulling things from it. It was quickly evident to Gord that Eclavdra had some kind of deomered bag. Clothing, weapons, and many other things came forth from inside the pack. Then the drow breathed an audible sigh as she reached inside once more and grabbed something. "There you are, dear Theopart, object of my success," she murmured aloud as she drew forth an oblong case of metal. Eclavdra placed the metal box on the ground before her and sat cross-legged before it. She then took a number of other objects she had drawn from her magically commodious pack and arrayed them about, surrounding herself and the rectangular coffer as she placed each little object down with care. There was some order to her activity, for the things each seemed to have a desired location. What she was setting down in the grass, though, and why she was doing all this, Gord was unable to determine. A crooning, wavering sound began to issue from deep inside the drow. Eclavdra had completed her placement of the little things, and now she sat motionless and brought forth the soft, barely discernible sound. It made Gord drowsy, and he had to blink to keep his eyes focused. He tensed his cat muscles, flexed his claws, and forced his mind to remain alert. The High Priestess began faint body movements then, little swayings and noddings of her head. At that, Gord looked quickly down, concentrating on the metal box. It had a grayish color in the moonlight, but so did everything else under this light that did not give off its own illumination. Could it be copper? No, it was too light a hue. Silver? No, too dark. Tin? Eclavdra had seemed to move it more carefully than a chest of tin would be handled. Brass, possibly, or maybe gold. His feline hearing noted a change in the sound coming from Eclavdra, even as he kept his eyes and thoughts elsewhere. Now the drow High Priestess had ceased making the noise that had almost mesmerized Gord, and was whisper-singing some weird chant, a paean of ghastly sort that made Gord Panther's flesh crawl. He thought the Dark Elf was now in the process of weaving some evil spell, and he dared not move, for that would surely alert Eclavdra to his presence. Why, Gord was not sure, but every one of his instincts, human and feline, screamed to him to remain undetected. Little points of light seemed to appear in the air, dancing like minute fireflies above the strange ring of objects the High Priestess had so carefully placed. Then the metal coffer began to glow with a dim, purplish luminosity. A faint chanting became more rapid, but no louder, and then the movements of Eclavdra's body and arms became faster and more contorted, seemingly defying human or elven physiology. Then suddenly the ritual ceased. Eclavdra halted all movement, and only a thin, sweet note came from her perfect throat. When Gord thought the note could be held no longer, he saw the dark elven cleric move slowly, so slowly, reaching toward the glowing box, the note incredibly sustained all the while. As her hands neared the coffer, the purple hue that it gave off changed, deepened, and became totally black. Now every hair on Gord's sleek, muscular body was standing straight up. He knew that at any instant his cat part would break through, and a growl of rage and fear would come from him at the same instant. An all-pervasive horror enveloped him. Awful, malign horror was about to be exposed. Evil was about to come pouring out, for Eclavdra was intent upon opening the coffer and releasing that which she had summoned. Inch by careful inch, Gord moved his cat body back, his panther nerves screaming to stop delaying, and bound away as fast as his four strong legs would carry him. Fighting for control, the human part of his mind forced his muscles to obey. As the drow's hands touched the metal chest, he was moving with utmost care, fully in control of himself, both as man and cat. Then Eclavdra's extended hands did something, and the box came open, its lid flying back at its own volition, or due to some force from within the container. When the scratchy, metallic sound of the lid's opening came to his ears, Gord could retain control of his cat body no longer. Feline instincts took over, and his panther body obeyed them. With a spring and a contortion in midair, Gord Panther was facing the opposite direction from the terrible scene and racing away at full speed. The human portion of his mind realized that... All right. So I'm going to take a little... I'm going to break right here. We had a little technical problem. And we see two things. Gygax is doing a wonderful description of the ceremony that Eclavdra is using. Now, this is not a normal spell from what I can see. Eclavdra has this box, and in it, it contains the final key of the artifact of all evil. Now, it was said that this is kind of like, described in a way like a black hole. It absorbs, it's so black, it absorbs light, and you can't physically touch it. Now, which is kind of, it's interesting, because I have no idea how Gord and Leda, or even Abmi, was quite prepared to take this, although Eclavdra was. Abmi may have been too. Now, Eclavdra, very smartly, was given a pouch of holding, or some kind of bag of holding, so she has a huge amount of material that she can pull out of that bag. And one of the things is this container. And she has this oblong metal coffer. And she, we're not told how she did it, but she got the artifact third key into that coffer, put it in her bag of holding, and left. And so now that they're outside, they're in the Sea Prince's area, around Lake Spendlow, a little north of there, around the Hul River. And the Eclavdra is pulling out the coffer, and she's doing this ceremony. Gord thinks it's a ceremony of summoning, but we always have to watch out for the unreliable narrator in Gygax's stories. And he consciously did this, where Gord is saying what he thinks it is, but later on we may find out that he's entirely mistaken. All right, and good news, the earlier recording is intact, so we're not going to start from the very beginning. But anyway, let me go on with this right here. So we have this that Gord, but it's a wonderful description of a ceremony. So I would say if you're a DM, you could cut if this bit right out here and add it right as some flavor text into a scenario. Just about any kind of evil summoning. It's a wonderful description. And then we have a very interesting description of Gord as a panther and his fighting his fear and his fight to control his panther instincts and eventually losing against that. And again, that is a wonderful description of how you could tell a character who has polymorphed or been changed into an animal form. And you know, it might not come up, but it's something to have in the bank there to be cut this little bit of description out and use it at a separate time. Now, as far as lore goes, we do see some information if you use these keyed artifacts and are doing a Tharistan campaign. The very, very important part and the description of the coffer, and that is a very important thing for how they're able to handle that third part of the artifact. So if we wanted to increase what we know about the third key, then we have from earlier the physical description of it, and then we have this ceremony to open the coffer, the idea of the coffer, that you need this, and Gord talking about what kind of metal it could be, you know, so there's a lot of interesting little tidbits here. Nothing really major, because I don't think a lot of people are going to run a Tharaston campaign. It's very heavy-handed. The artifacts are the keys. This is the third final key. They are not mentioned anywhere out of the Gord campaign. They were not mentioned earlier when the Folio and 83 box set were written. They are not mentioned in any later material that I've seen. So, you know, this is a little bit of lore, but it's kind of apocryphal, and it's kind of like the material that, you know, has been cut out of some religious text that is not used. And in this sense, I think that this business about the keys and Tharaston is not heavily used. It's a very heavy-handed campaign. Gygax himself destroyed the entire Earth with this campaign. So I think it's an important little bit of lore history, but I'm not as sure about the utility of it. But again, it's definitely worth noting down. All right. So I'm going to restart here. And again, just at a paragraph, because it's a wonderful bit of story, too, I've got to say. I really enjoy that. I'm sorry it got cut like that. I wasn't going to break at that point to discuss those mentions, but I did have to because of the technical problem. So I'm going to restart. It's page number 353 and the second paragraph down from the top. Now every hair on Gord's sleek, muscular body was standing straight up. He knew that at any instant his cat part would break through, and a growl of rage and fear would come from him at the same instant. An all-pervasive horror enveloped him. Awful, malign horror was about to be exposed. Evil was about to come pouring out, for Ecclavdra was intent upon opening the coffer and releasing that which she had summoned. Inch by careful inch, Gord moved his cat body back, his panther nerves screaming to stop delaying, and bound away as fast as his four strong legs would carry him. Fighting for control, the human part of his mind forced his muscles to obey. As the drow's hands touched the metal chest, he was moving with utmost care, fully in control of himself, both as man and cat. Then Eclavdra's extended hands did something, and the box came open, its lid flying back of its own volition, or due to some force from within the container. When the scratchy metallic sound of the lid's opening came to his ears, Gord could retain control of his cat body no longer. Feline instincts took over, and his panther body obeyed them. With a spring and a contortion in midair, Gord Panther was facing the opposite direction from the terrible scene and racing away at full speed. The human portion of his mind realized that there was obviously no chance to steal the final key from the wicked elf now. His cat brain did not care about such a consideration, simply wishing to put as much distance between itself and Ecclavdra as it could. Gord streaked through the night in ebony bounds, making away from the dell faster than any normal leopard could have run. Then in mid-stride, when he was quite some distance away from Ecclavdra, something stopped him. A wave of purest evil swept over Gord Panther, traveling as fast as thought. Far, far more quickly than even he could run, he collapsed and rolled, his momentum taking him onward as his muscles contracted in agony at the impact of the wave. Then his body stopped rolling, shuddered and twitched. As Gord lost consciousness, he felt himself changing, altering form again, but this time painfully. He was returning once more to his man shape, and he had no control. Then blackness as deep as that of the Theopart overcame him, and the young adventurer could think no more. Break. All right, that is the end of chapter 22. And no, there's a comment that this is the big finale. No, this was a very, I think, interesting and a well-written part of Gygax's story. And I complain quite a bit about Gygax and some of the choices that he makes and things he does and doesn't do and say. But at this point right here, I found this everything from... this whole point through here I found very, very interesting. This was just page 354. We are very near the end of the story. We have Ecladra opening the box containing the third key. And when she does, this wave of evil comes out that actually seems to paralyze Gord. Now, I noticed there's a post of what I think is a second edition mention of an artifact connected with Tharizdun. I can't really see it on our text channel myself, but it was mentioned that there was a Tharizdun artifact mentioned in the Scarlet Brotherhood book, which isn't by Sargent. That's... That seemed like the Theopart. Now, that book is Sean Reynolds. All right, another little technical glitch. So, we were talking about, in the Sean Reynolds Scarlet Brotherhood book, that there is a thing called, I believe this is it, that Chris has put up, the Weeping Hexagram. It's a minor artifact, and it is found by something called Ziggurat of Black. A 10-foot diameter ring of black iron inset with a bowed hexagram, seeped blood exposed to sunlight, and it was believed to be tied to Tharizdun. Erroneous. A paladin of Heronius broke the hexagram into three pieces. And that, again, does seem very similar to the three-part artifact of all evil. Although, of course, the keys and everything we're talking about here, they are like the ultimate artifacts, and... They are not broken per se. They are three keys that can be joined together. But yes, that does seem to be an homage to the artifact of all evil here. All right, I am going to restart. It is the beginning of chapter 23, page 355, and paragraph 1. Obmi, do you sense it? What are you blathering of, drow bitch? Stop being an asshole for once, you dwarven dunderhead, and try to think rationally, Lita told him acidly. It just could be that I have a real brain inside my skull. The dwarf started to retort, then made a face and said only, All right, I'll play along. What are you saying I should magically sense? I don't think it's anything magic at all, you shithead. Something is happening over there in Ecladra's camp. Can't you feel that she's up to something? No. Well, I can. Take my word for it, and be prepared. Alert the marshman if you have a mind to. She's working up something very, very bad and powerful. If we don't do something quickly to counter her, you can kiss your precious ass goodbye. That made Obmi uneasy. He had scant respect for females, less so for elven females, and least of all for dark elven bitches. Still, this Lita seemed above her type, and she was somehow attuned to the machinations of Ecladra. With those thoughts in mind, Abmi decided to violate his strict orders and seek guidance from the one whose cause he championed. If his adversary dared to break the pact, then why should he not do the same? I call upon the power of Zuckmoy, the dwarf. Pardon me, change of page. Intoned softly. When nothing happened after a few heartbeats, he repeated the call a second time, this time more loudly and at more length, adding the name of her kin. I, Abmi, champion of Queen Zuckmoy, beseech her in the name of Shuzblox to come to my aid. His gut felt awful after he spoke, but no tangible manifestations of the demoness appeared. Let me try, Leda suggested. Groaning, Abmi muttered, go ahead, but once only. As soon as these pangs reside, I shall bring the mighty queen of the... Right, just shut up a moment and give me one try, then. The dwarf clamped his teeth shut with a snap, and the dark elf began her conjuration. I call upon the power of the abyss on its 666 planes and forbidden names. O Zuckmoy, queen of fungi, she of chaos... Zuckmoy, whose very name strikes terror into the hearts of all, your humble servant urge. An ear-splitting screech cut through the air. Leda halted her incantation, but even if she had not, the shrill noise would have drowned it out to all listeners on this plane, and perhaps other planes as well. Then the atmosphere around Abmi and Leda began to grow thick, and they became aware of a foul stench emanating from some other place. Bah, growled Abmi when the screech subsided. My call got no results, but yours was worse. What have you wrought, black bitch? Shut your mouth and gather your senses, if that is possible, Leda shot back at him. The uproar comes from Eclavdra's camp, you fool. She's up to something big. And you had better gather your puny forces and attack before things get any worse. All right, break. Yes, such language. And, you know, Gygax, unfortunately, had... I'm sure this was very strongly appealing to all the, you know, 11 to 15-year-olds, or, you know, maybe even a little older who read it, but... you know, it is, I don't know, I find it very jarring myself, but that's just the storyline. It doesn't really affect much of anything. So, you know, we have this summoning by Eclavdra and the wave of evil that comes from it. So it's, you know, good to note if you're doing that kind of campaign. And then you have Abmi doing a kind of summoning of Zuckmoy. Now, we've had Zuckmoy imprisoned in the Temple of Elemental Evil, so she did have a presence on Earth. And then in the story, Yggdrasil actually is the one who comes down and frees her. Now, in the normal campaign, and even in what had been said, the various powers and deities, they aren't really supposed to be able to do so many of these appearances upon the earthly plane. And it's one of the reasons why Uz was so powerful is that he actually was able to, you know, to be on Earth because he was half human, and yet, you know, still immensely, almost, you know, partially a deity. So, like Cuthbert, and so the two kind of balanced each other. But so far in this book, we've seen several of the like Nerol. Make an actual appearance in not saying it's Nero's avatar or anything. And in this, it's just wondering, is he able to actually bring Zuckmoy to Earth? And there's an implication when in Artifact of Evil at the end, when Abmi had the second artifact, that Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy actually appeared and retrieved Abmi, turning him into a frog, and the artifact from where he was in the northern Vesve forest. Now, you know, Chris says that, you know, that the language coming from Abby is in character. And yes, it is. It's in character for almost any of the evil characters. I find it jarring because it just doesn't seem, I don't know, I just don't feel it really fits. I mean, it's the kind of language you might hear in a 1980s schoolyard, and I just don't think it fits in with the story all that well. I mean, some other kind of explicatives might have been much better. Now, it is also incredibly it's non-politically correct. It's the 1980s and a lot of the commentary, but that is part of the story. Some of his explicatives have become much more offensive. I guess they always were offensive, but they are more noted now for their offensiveness. So, you know, that's in there too. And it is something where people reading the stories, it is something I think they be prepared for. And we are old. You know, we are, a lot of us, I'm old, and this kind of thing doesn't shock me at all. But, you know, it's the times that we were in, and the times are different now. And society has moved on to, different direction. All right. Now, I am going to restart. And it is page number 356 and the final paragraph. All right. The screech, originating from a point in the air only feet away from where Eclavdra sat, would have deafened any normal being from that distance, and the awful odor that accompanied the sound would have sickened anyone else who got the full force of it. But Eclavdra was no ordinary being. She sat quietly watching as the events she had set in motion unfolded. As the shrill sound dissipated, it was replaced by a tearing noise. Monstrous taloned hands appeared in mid-air, a few feet off the ground, their fingers gripping something as unseen as if by the edges. The ripping sound continued, and more of the creature owning the disembodied clawed hands became clearly visible through a rent, literally a tear in the fabric of space, plainly discernible in the air. A hideous evil head thrust itself through the unnatural opening, and then a massive arm poked out, its huge hand reaching toward the drow as the face leered and said, "Wanna fool around?" The fiend's exact intentions were unclear, perhaps even to itself. Eclavdra merely rested her left hand on the brass box and pointed her right index finger. A purple-black spark jumped from the outstretched digit to the creature's forehead, and it stopped grinning and howled. "Little lizard demon, listen carefully, or I shall allow the force to wholly devour you," Eclavdra said in a low, threatening voice. "Leave the gate I have readied, and get your ilk together. You know by what power I summon you all, so do not delay an instant longer." The daemon disappeared, leaving the strange hole in the air empty. The dark elven priestess sang another brief, hideous chant, and something else appeared in the opening. Another daemon, this one having five arms and an insect-like head. The creature clicked its mandibles hungrily at the sight of her, and Eclavdra treated this creature to a taste of the fell power drawn from the theopart, just as she had done with the previous one. The insect demon then received its instructions and disappeared. After a few minutes, demons began coming through the unusual gate in a steady flow. All right, break. Chris mentions that, Eclavdra is not mentioning rats, and rather than demons, these are actually daemons. And So it makes me wonder. Now, Digax at this point had still been using AD&D. And so I wonder if we could determine which of these daemons they are from, say, the Monster Manual 2, Fiend Folio, or from what book that they may have come from. And, like the insect-like one is actually, probably more a description than the other one that's just kind of big and big hands, big arms. So, now, it shows also that the command that she is using, she's actually using the Theopart and using, its power to both summon and protect herself. So, we have been wondering, we had seen that the Scarlet Brotherhood possesses the first Theopart. And then out in the Sus Forest had been the second, which was retrieved by Obmi and now is in the possession of Yggdrasil. And we have not really seen how they are used. So I think this is the first example that we're seeing how these Theoparts are actually used. And, we get, like I said, we have Ecclavdra doing her, placing her objects around it as Gord sees, and doing her chant and her, strange intonations. And so there is a, all the parts of a spell in AD&D are there, the verbal, the somatic, the material. And so, we see that, like Gord thought, there's an evil spell being cast. And, is it that the Theopart is an aid in the sense that a summoning spell is directly aided? Now, she's talking here about a gate, and we see the fabric of space being ripped by these daemons. And so she has said that's a gate. So her summoning, does the summoning open up a gate and call forth these daemons, or is the daemons opening up the gate after being summoned? But we don't know that. All right, I am going to restart. And it is page 358. All right, and it's second paragraph down from the top. Without saying a word, both type of daemons knew by what they had been summoned and what they were to do. The giant-sized lizard daemons ambled off toward the center of the enemy line, while the three-legged insect daemons trooped toward either side. Ecclavdra meant to encircle and crush her attackers with an overwhelming force of daemons, monsters from Hades conjured through the power of the Theopart. Despite her knowledge that she was acting in a fashion that would attract all powers watching for even minor occurrences of such sort, the Drow High Priestess drew upon the awful nature of the final key to wreak havoc on those who dared to challenge her. All right, so break. And now, each one of the keys, Therizdin's supposed to have power over all the different, evil creatures. And Uz, of course, had, was linked and gratzed with the chaotic evil demons. And the devils are lawful evil. And they're under, the Scarlet Brotherhood. And the Hierarchs, who've been crushed, they were the neutral evil. And daemons, I believe, are the neutral evil. So, but they're because of that, there can be summoned by any of these various people without having like a direct pact to that chaotic or lawful nature. Now, Gygax was very wedded to the idea of these alignments, and he have even talked about alignment language as being a thing in the setting, not in the game, but actually At one point mentioning that the alignment language is that there was a chaotic evil alignment language kind of thing, which I found, you know, very ridiculous. But, you know, it's actually mentioned in, I believe, Artifact of Evil. All right. Now, so here she is, and she is a servant of chaotic evil summoning up neutral evil. But I believe that that's always possible, that the neutral evil daemons can be, they're almost like mercenaries. They can be summoned by anyone.
Nerl's neutral evil, right?
I don't know. I don't know offhand.
I think he is, because he was the head hierarch, at least in the book.
Yes, it was shocking when Nerl, and also appeared to be on Earth in his own form, rather than, you know, being represented by like an avatar or something. But I don't know. He could have been an avatar. Gygax doesn't mention it. So, yes, it's commented that Nerl is neutral evil. So that fits in very well with the idea that the three major evil powers each encapsulated one of the alignment, you know, the major alignment variations, chaotic, lawful, and neutral. All right, so the daemons, like I said, because of that neutrality, I believe that they have been mentioned before as being like summoned up by even Uz or Gratzt or something. I just now, you know, they're not, rather than creatures of the abyss, I believe they're creatures of the separate planes like Hades and Gahanna and such. All right. Here, one of the reasons I broke was we get a better description, she had mentioned the one daemon is a lizard daemon, and the other is the insect daemon with three legs. So I think that if you know, we look, we might be able to find which ones these are supposed to be, or else these are brand new ones, you know, that Gygax has created for the story. Something he has done on occasion in both other books.
I did look in the Monster Manual, too, for daemons, and I couldn't find one that was insectoid. Yeah, I found one that was like a lobster, but not...
Well, then he's come up with two new ones, which I kind of like even better, the idea that we're actually being treated to some new material.
Right.
So worth noting that we perhaps have two new daemons here. Very, very low details, though. Now, it also says in this paragraph here, it directly says then that she has conjured them through the power of the Theopart. Now, the other thing it mentions is that using that power is revealing herself. And that is something that I don't, you know, as Gygax has kind of mentioned before, when the Cat Lord and Basiliv were talking about being able to cross from various planes, they talked about divination magic and how other beings are kind of out there and aware of them and stuff, and how they've blocked a lot of the ability to travel from plane to plane. So, you know, in this, you hadn't really gotten much information previously about kind of like this ability that when you are casting spells, it's making an appearance. It's like giving off a signal to other planar creatures or powers. Now, it's commented here that these are Kala Mereloths, and I'm not familiar with them, and I'm not sure which source book they're from. All right. And I am going to restart. It is page 358, and it is the third paragraph down from the top. Abmi, meanwhile, had proceeded with his assault too late. The hapless marshmen, expecting to encounter a force many times smaller in number than they were, instead found themselves charging into the arms of the waiting demons. Yells and screams of terror and pain from the marshmen alerted the dwarf, who lurked far to the rear of the battleground, and in moments he was aware of the general circumstances. He did not know what his mercenary force had encountered, but clearly it was more formidable than a small group of humans and a couple of drow spell users. Lita had darted off in the confusion and was nowhere to be found. The dwarf considered beseeching his mistress for aid once again, but did not know if the call would be answered, and besides, he didn't have time to make another attempt. Growling curses under his breath, Abmi did the only thing he could. The broad-shouldered dwarf brought forth a tiny bronze figurine that Zuckmoy had secretly given him, with instructions to employ it only if he found himself alone and threatened by ultimate failure. With a powerful twist, he snapped the head off the figure's body. Although Abmi did not know this at the time, a statuette was formed in the likeness of the demon Yuliel, one of the most powerful who served Zuckmoy. With the snapping of the old bronze, flame shot forth from the body of the little idol, and the metal grew scorchingly hot. The dwarf uttered a sharp sound of pain and flung the thing a few feet away from him. As the statuette was consumed, Uliel took shape in the air above, a solid form composed of blackish shadow and licking fingers of flame. The huge demon glared at Ami only briefly, then turned so as to magically perceive what was happening on the battleground beyond. "You have not erred, dwarf," the demon said in a voice that made the very air vibrate. The shadows deepened around the creature, and the flames grew bigger and brighter. A booming sound echoed in the air above the demon's head, and in the next instant, another monster from the abyss was beside Yuliel. Bear demon, the bigger demon grated to the lesser one. "In the name of she you serve, summon the thralls of our queen." All right, break. So, there's several comments here. So one of the traits of these demons is that they gate in other demons. And so we have this little artifact. So that's a little bit of lore, that we have this little bronze shape of this demon, and it's something that Abmi is using to summon the demon. Now I haven't really heard that before, and I like the way that he's supposed to break the head off of it to perform the summoning. And then this powerful, the most powerful demon under the command of Zuckmoy. Now, Zuckmoy is, again, a very powerful demoness. And I believe she controls, I'm not sure, I think she controls a layer of the abyss. So anyway, as soon as this demon appears, he summons another and tells that one to summon some more. So that is one of, in a game, it is one of the things that makes using the demon so much, such a dangerous foe, is that all of a sudden one can turn into two, into three, into four, and suddenly, you know, there's this line of lesser ones that are appearing, so just one of them can suddenly become a big group that you have to fight. All right. Now, later on in second edition, we have the business with all the demons and such that appear on Earth and then are thrown out by the Crook of Rao. And you can kind of see where I had heard, and I'd read actually recently, that Sargent was familiar with this manuscript. And that you could kind of see, at least someone should have been, who was describing some of the events that happened later on in second edition with, the Greyhawk Wars and this infestation of these demonic creatures into the earth that are, that are banished by the Crook of Rao. All right, we're getting near the end of the night. And I'm going to read a little more right here. This has been an excellent part of the story. I think Guy Gax's prose, his ability to describe action scenes has improved, even from the parts that I really liked in the earlier books. I think this section right here really shows that he is progressing as a writer. Right, and I'm going to begin again. It is the second paragraph from the end of page 359. The smaller demon appeared to be a mixture of the worst features of a ravening boar, a carnivorous gorilla, and a human. It grunted a snarling yet obedient sound, and squealing, gibbering notes issued from the air in front of its huge chest. Then a popping sound issued forth, and on the ground before the boar, ape-human demon, was a batrachian needle thing, its gaping mouth filled with 100 needle-like teeth. Toad demon, bring those of your sort who serve you, the boar demon commanded. Croaking in reply, the ugly beast hunkered down on its bent legs and began to make sounds such as a bullfrog of monstrous sort might give off during spring courtship. The greatest of the three demons present, Uliel nodded his horned head, a head that was above that of the 10-foot-high boar demon beside him. You obey and live. See that the toad demons propagate thus until I say otherwise. Send them forth immediately upon their bringing forth a companion of theirs. They are needed to contend with the spawn of Hades, who swarm toward us now. With that, the demon of flame and shadow stalked toward the daemons, and the first toad demon hopped and croaked at its heels as he went. For already that creature had brought forth another, and the second was summoning a third. Soon demons fought with daemons, while the few remaining men sought to hide, trembling in fear at the struggle that now was being waged in the remote grassland beside the Ochre River. Break. The Ochre River is the whole river in New Infinity speak. And again, this is a great example here. And here the big demon is having the toad demon. Every new one summons another, and that one summons another. And ad infinity, so that this endless line of these toad demons is just coming and coming and coming to reinforce Uliel and the boar demon. All right. It's page 360 and the second paragraph down. Oh, no, third paragraph down. Meanwhile, Leda had not been idle. When the dwarf rushed off at her urging to spur the marshmen to action, she had held back and then employed a ring to invisibly slip away from him. Her first invocation had gone unfinished and thus unfulfilled, but Leda still had hope that she could successfully call upon assistance from beyond, if she could get to a secluded place and begin the process anew, this time carrying it to its completion. When she came upon a small clearing from which the ongoing struggle could be heard, but not seen, Leda knelt and began to utter as elaborate a plea as she could formulate. She actually fell into a trance-like state while continuing to call for aid. And finally, after an indeterminate amount of time had passed, she got what she was asking for. Or perhaps the maelstrom of daemons and demons being brought to the material plane by other forces was the trigger. For whatever reasons, the Queen of Demons finally brought her attention to the place where Leda invoked her. In the first instant that form appeared, Zuckmoy was livid. "How dare you, bitch of Gratz," she said in her growling, burbling tone. And then Zuckmoy paused, for her assessment of Leda made her aware of the fact that this was not Eclavdra herself, but a clone, not clone, of the drow who served the six-fingered lord. In the next instant, as Leda came back to full awareness, Zuckmoy transformed herself from human form to a towering fungoid thing with vegetable eyes that saw in all directions around the copse. "This is madness. We are undone," the Queen of Fungi said in her strange, hollow tone in a voice that seemed to issue from inside a rotten log and sent a pungent odor of mold and decay wafting toward the little dark elf cowering nearby. Lita could not know exactly what caused the demoness to exclaim so, but the problem was evident to her. Zuckmoy and all the other demons involved in the contest had wanted total and complete secrecy. Now, all of the beings in the multiverse who sought the last portion of the artifact of evil were alerted to its location and were certain to react swiftly and with all their might. All right. At that point, I'm going to end for the night. Jumping away in the middle of this story, but it's the hour, even with our brief pauses of technical trouble. And so we have, again, a different kind of rule system, I think, in Gygax's Gord Greyhawk. And we now have Zuckmoy appearing, first as a human and then as her fungoid form. And wonderful descriptions, again. And so it also, it does talk about the business with all these other searchers now being aware because of the invocation of Ecclavdra. And it does talk about how there are all these other things coming to look and who are going to appear, and that this fight is going to get much worse than it already has. Now, we saw a kind of foreshadowing of this back when Yggdrasil created a small pocket dimension and had a meeting with Gratzt. And the two of them, and they brought Zuckmoy and Shublox, and then Gratzt brought Yanogo, the Gnoll Lord, and Kasachi, another demon. And pretty soon, they got angry with each other and started summoning all these other demons and daemons, and the plane, the temporary plane created by Yggdrasil was threatening to come apart and perhaps destroy them all. So here on Earth now we see Ecclavdra summons daemons, Obmi summons demons, and now all these other forces are seeing. So it sounds like a grand battle is coming. All right, that's it for tonight. We're going to continue tomorrow, and we are getting very close to the end of the story. At the end of the book, the story does continue even afterward. All right, good night, everyone.